Okay.
Pleased to have Gerald talk
more about ideal triangulations.
Okay, so the plan for today is to give a sort of explicit example of a hyperbolic three-manifold triangulated with ideal tetrahedra. It's going to have some totally geodesic boundary, and it's going to have some rank 1 cusps, annular cusps, and some rank 2 cusps, torus cusps. And it's, I mean, it's sort of explicit in, you could make it really explicit, but, okay, so the basic starting point is a regular ideal tetrahedron, free simplex in hyperbolic space. And so this is supposed to be a picture of hyperbolic 3 space, and regular ideal tetrahedron, the one thing one needs to know is that the dihedral angles between any pair of faces is a pi over 3. So if you take one of those in hyperbolic space, you can tessellate hyperbolic space by copies of that. And the way you do that is you think about one of the faces of this tetrahedron and you do a hyperbolic reflection across that face. So that will give you another tetrahedron that meets the original one along that face. And you get to do that along each of the four faces. So that gives you four reflections, tau 1, tau 2, tau 3, and tau 4. And then you take the group they generate of hyperbolic isometries and you reflect this tetrahedron around and you get a tessellation of hyperbolic 3 space by copies of this regular ideal tetrahedron. All their interiors are disjoint. So I did spend a fruitless 15 minutes trying to find a picture of this on the internet and failed. Anyway, the thing is, of course, around each edge of each 3 simplex, you have exactly 3 tetrahedra around that. And then if you take the group of symmetries of this tiling, so the group of hyperbolic isometries that send the union of these 3 simplices, sends each 3 simplex to another one in the family, that's a discrete group. And it's an orbifold group, and the quotient of hyperbolic space by that group, well, it won't actually be this simplex, it will be the quotient of this simplex by the group of symmetries of this simplex. And anyway, the group of all symmetries contains the group that we started with, the tessellation group. So this group generated by the reflections is a Coxeter group. It's the 4 reflections in the faces have order 2, and you take a pair of reflections that corresponds to rotation around an edge by 2 pi over 3, so the third pair is the identity. Again, there's another group. This is a group of finite index in the group of all symmetries, and a different group of finite index in the group of all symmetries has the property that when you quotient out hyperbolic 3 space by that other group, you get the figure 8 knot complement. You get the 3 sphere with this particular knot removed. And so there's a way of taking 2 of these ideal simplices and gluing their faces and getting the figure 8 knot complement. So I'm calling that manifold M8 for the figure 8 knot. Now, what I'm going to do is, so there's a finite covering of this manifold, a finite covering called N. So that's some, so this hyperbolic 3 manifold, it's got 1 torus cusp. And what I want to do is produce from it another hyperbolic 3 manifold with some totally geodesic boundary. And so made up, oh, and I see one of my edges is missing. Oh, yes. So, Okay, so we've got hyperbolic three space tessellated by copies of this regular ideal, three simplex. If you take one of the faces of this three simplex, so I've numbered the vertices 1, 2, 3, 4. If you take the face of this three simplex opposite vertex 4, that's some triangle. And now there's a hyperbolic plane, P, containing that triangle. Some two-dimensional hyperbolic space in this hyperbolic three space. And that's called P. And now if you think about it, you can think about how all these tetrahedra intersect P. And something nice happens because there are the dihedral angles, the angles between two faces here are pi over 3. If you look along one of these edges, if you take three of these tetrahedra around this edge, their two faces are coplanar. And so what that means is that we've got the plane containing this triangle. The way it meets the tetrahedra in this tessellation is in this a triangulation of a hyperbolic plane. So this is slightly misleading. So the triangulation of the hyperbolic plane, actually, what it will look like. So if you have the, this is plane P. How the three simplices meet this plane is in this fairy triangulation. So this is what the tessellation of P looks like. And so on. And then, but there's a quotient, there's a the group of symmetries. If you take the subgroup of the group of symmetries that preserve this hyperbolic plane, there's a subgroup in that group. The quotient of that hyperbolic plane is a torus with four punctures. And I've kind of indicated the a doubly infinite cyclic covering of the torus here. So the deal is that there's a certain subgroup of this group of symmetries, and the quotient of that, and that group preserves this plane, and the quotient of the plane by that group is a four-punctured.
Confused here. That looks like a very planar picture rather than a hyperbolic picture.
This picture?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if I take the universal cover of this picture, I'll get the hyperbolic plane. So topologically, I've got here a torus with four punctures in. I've taken the universal covering of the torus, and now what I've got is a multiply punctured plane. So this is actually a hyperbolic plane with lots of punctures. It's got lots of cusps in it. And if I now take the universal cover of that, we'd get that picture. Okay, so now we get to... So that means, actually, there's a map of this surface into the figure 8 knot complement. But this surface will, when you map it down into the figure 8 knot complement, will crash through itself. There's a theorem of Darren Long, though, that says in this situation, you can find a finite sheeted covering of the manifold, in this case, the figure 8 knot, a finite sheeted covering, so this surface is actually embedded in there. And if you're prepared to spend the time, you can make this very explicit. So, so what this means is there is some... there's a group of symmetries, a subgroup of this group of symmetries of the tiling corresponding to this manifold N. And sitting inside that, there's another subgroup corresponding to this surface group. Geometrically, there's this hyperbolic 3 manifold, and this surface is sitting inside it in an embedded way. So now one can take the manifold N and cut it open along the surface W. Cut it open along the surface F. So now what you've got is you've got this cut open manifold. So this cut open manifold is tessellated by regular ideal tetrahedra. Its boundary consists of two copies of this surface. I've called them F plus and F minus. If you glue these two boundary components together suitably, you get back to that manifold N. So this is N cut open along the surface F. And, you know, there are various... Well, so it's tessellated by these regular ideal tetrahedra. The boundary is totally geodesic. It's tessellated by the unglued faces. There are probably some rank 2 cusps, things that you can think of as covering of a torus cusp of the figure 8 knot. And then there are some rank 1 cusps, which are kind of topologically, they're annuli, running between boundary components. So this is an example of the kind of manifold that Gukov and co. are using to construct a theory. And it's a very nice one because it's actually triangulated by regular ideal tetrahedra.
How do we figure out what these cusps are? I understand how the boundary is calculated, but you've got little blue lines wandering off.
Yeah, so... So topologically, you've drilled out a hole. So you could kind of imagine this filled in, and then the way you get this manifold is you drill out an arc that goes from one to this. This is a closed manifold. Well, sorry, this is a manifold with two boundary components, and there are some arcs in it. Maybe some arcs go from one boundary component to the other. Maybe some arcs go from a boundary component back to itself. And then you drill those out, and those are the rank one cusps.
So did the torus meet the knot initially? I guess what I'm missing is how...
So the surface F, a more suggestive, more traditional picture of the surface F, it's abstractly, it's a torus with four cusps. So you might imagine drawing the torus with four cusps in a kind of, here's a cusp and here's a cusp and here's a cusp and here's a cusp. And so this is some torus with four cusps in it. And then these cusps, well, this is an annulus, and it's shrinking. And this annulus comes into the knot complement boundary. So the figure 8 knot, I don't know if I can draw the figure 8 knot. If I go very slowly, I can. There's the figure 8 knot. And now the figure 8 knot's not there. So what's there is a kind of torus neighbourhood of it. And then the boundary, this surface has got four boundary components. And so as you go out along this annulus, you're coming in towards this figure eight knot. So it might be that you come in along this curve, the meridian, but actually you come in along some curve that we could work out, that's on the boundary of this torus. And so does that answer your question? Yeah. So that's kind of how it sits. You can kind of, another way of thinking about it in the universal cover, or what you see, just see the hyperbolic space. Here's hyperbolic 3 space, a kind of ball. And now if you take a neighbourhood of the cusp for the figure 8 knot, that's a horosphere, that's a kind of smaller ball. So this is the boundary. What's inside this ball is what's inside that cusp. And then this totally geodesic surface meets this horosphere in some, well, it's a plane to start with. So what P looks like is it's some, This is in the universal cover, of course. And so it crashes through the boundary of this horosphere in some geodesic on the horosphere, some Euclidean geodesic, this curve. And that's what covers whatever this is. So in the universal cover, the kind of picture is, in one dimension lower, so what you see is you see planes coming in like this. So I'm drawing a pencil of lines coming into a point. Actually, it's something like a pencil of hyperbolic planes coming in. So that's kind of what the picture looks like. Actually, it's a bit more complicated than that because it wasn't embedded, so actually there's some other families, but yeah. These aren't geodesics. One of the irritating things about this picture is that the blue stuff isn't there. So there's a question about how you draw it. So if you were to, I mean, there is a manifold where you fill in and then you cut out the blue arcs, but the problem is that that manifold might not be hyperbolic, and if it is hyperbolic, its hyperbolic metric isn't related to that hyperbolic metric. And if it is hyperbolic, well, maybe there's a hyperbolic structure which is totally geodesic. And then you can ask about if these arcs are knotted or not. Well, I don't know. And it's kind of the wrong question because...
Then I just don't really understand what's happening in the figure. Maybe you can refresh or what happened.
So what the blocks is supposed to imagine, first of all, a compact manifold with two boundary components, which are tori, and then an ant or a worm, a woodworm, comes in and drills out a hole along these blue arcs, and so they're gone. And before he drills out the doing the boring, you're in some other manifold where those arcs may or may not be knotted. But that's different to the one you end up in. Okay, so Dave asked for some kind of specific example. Well, I don't know if this qualifies. So the next thing one needs to make the physics series Packner moves. So you do something depending on a triangulation, and you want to know it doesn't depend on the triangulation. So there's a theorem due to Packner in 1987. It's also due to Newman in 1926. I guess Newman has priority. And so the deal is, so Packner moves are a way of going between different triangulations of the same combinatorially triangulated manifold. This works in any dimension. And the basic point is, if you have an n-simplex, you can think of that n-simplex as a join of two simplices of lower dimension. So, for example, a two-simplex is a join of a one-simplex and a vertex. Every point in the simplex B is connected by a straight line segment to every point in the simplex A, and that produces you a simplex of dimension A plus dimension B plus an extra one for the lines going across. And then if you think about the boundary of, so a simplex of dimension A plus B plus 1, there are various ways to think about it as a join of an A simplex and a B simplex. You get to pick A and B, and they have to add up to be less, one less than the dimension N you're working in. And so the point is that you can, if you take the boundary of this simplex, this N simplex, topologically it's a sphere of dimension N minus 1, and it's a sphere triangulated with n minus 1 simplices, and the number of n minus 1 simplices is n plus 1. You can break up the boundary, the triangulation of the boundary of the simplex, into two groups. The boundary of A joined B is the boundary of A joined to B, and A joined the boundary of B. So it's a way of breaking up the boundary of this simplex, and this part has got A plus 1 simplices of dimension more. That says n minus 1 in it. And the other part's got b plus 1, simplices dimension n minus 1. So in this example, b's dimension 0. So the boundary here is the first part, the boundary of A join B. The boundary of A, these two points, join to B. That gives you these two line segments. So that's that. And then the other part of the boundary, A join the boundary of B. Well, we have to do something special here because B's a point and the boundary of B is the empty set, and so we declare that the boundary, that A join the boundary of B is just A in that case, which is this bit. And so then a Packner move of type A plus 1 goes to B plus 1. What that means is if you have a triangulation manifold and somewhere you see in it this part, you pull this part out and you glue this part in. And it all matches up along the boundary. So another way to think of that is that we've got an n-dimensional manifold. We've got a manifold of dimension n minus 1. And in that n minus 1 dimensional manifold, we see this subcomplex somewhere. So in this n minus 1 dimensional manifold, we see this subcomplex. We glue on an n-simplex along this part of the boundary. So this part of the boundary disappears, and what's left is this part of the boundary. So you can think of this operation as you take a manifold of some dimension and you glue onto it a simplex of one higher dimension along part of its boundary. And the new boundary that appears is what is the result of the Packner move. So in dimension 2, if you do a 2-2 move, then we're dealing here with a two-dimensional manifold, and we're replacing two triangles with an edge going one way by two triangles with the edge going the other way, which you can think of as gluing on a three simplex along two edges, and then the new boundary becomes that. And a 2-3 move on a three manifold, you're going from two simplices to three simplices, which you can imagine is gluing on a four simplex by this part of the boundary of the four simplex, and this is the part that remains. And so the theorem is that when you're moving between combinatorial triangulations of manifolds, this is all you have to do. This is the same as the more general notion of equivalence of triangulations, combinatorial triangulations. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to talk about is the gluing equations, the completeness condition, Lagrangians, and phase space and Fock-Gongerov coordinates. So, plenty of time. So here is a kind of diagram of a hyperbolic free manifold that, I haven't got any totally geodesic boundary, but there's a cusp. And that three manifold is supposed to be triangulated, so it's divided up into ideal three-dimensional simplices, and those ideal three-dimensional simplices kind of have spikes that go out into the cusp. So the picture's clearer in the universal cover. In the universal cover, here we have hyperbolic three space. In the universal cover of this cusp, we have a horrible, and in the universal cover, we have a three simplex that crashes through the horror ball, and this spike of the three simplex goes out to the parabolic fixed point. And where it enters the horror ball, where it intersects the horror sphere, is this red triangle. Downstairs in the manifold, the quotient of this horror sphere is a torus. as you go out into the cusp, this area of this torus shrinks, the size of this torus shrinks exponentially. As you go out here, that corresponds to going inwards in this picture in hyperbolic space, passing through smaller and smaller horribles towards the parabolic fixed point. In this picture, the kind of parabolic fixed point would be out that way. So there's something called the completeness condition. And so in attempting to construct a hyperbolic structure on this manifold, one glues together ideal tetrahedra, ideal simplices along faces. And there's a condition that has to be satisfied around edges. I talked about this last time. When you kind of glue these simplices around an edge, the angles have to add up to be 2 pi. Actually, that's a real condition. There's actually a complex condition that has to be satisfied, and that's the real part of a kind of complex angle that has to work out. And if it's a closed manifold, that's all you have to worry about. But when there are cusps, there's this extra condition. And the point is that when you glue those simplices together, you get a metric space, but the metric space might not be complete. There might be a Cauchy sequence that doesn't converge. You're supposed to end up with a cusp that's kind of infinite distance going out into the cusp. But if you glue the 3 simplices together wrongly, then in fact it doesn't happen. Just like in the 2-dimensional situation, these kinds of things can spiral, and you get an incomplete manifold. So I'm about to describe this completeness condition. And so what I want to say is that the no matter how these simplices are glued together, you're going to get a similarity structure on the torus. And the condition that this manifold is complete is that that similarity structure is actually a Euclidean structure. So let me just say where all this comes from. So we've got this manifold, this 3 manifold, which is obtained by gluing together ideal tetrahedra. And so in the universal cover, we can think about all these tetrahedra glued together. And I want to look what's going on at the parabolic fixed point. So to do that, one takes the upper half space model and look at the simplices that have spikes going out into this cusp. So in the upper half space model, these simplices have 3 vertices kind of on the complex plane, the floor of the upper half space model. And the 4th simplex is at infinity in the upper half space model P. So these 3 simplices, what they consist of, you have a Euclidean triangle in the plane at height 0. And then you've got a 4th vertex up here. And the simplex is kind of the convex hull of those points at infinity. So the part of you can kind of take cross sections through this tetrahedron using horizontal planes in the upper half space model. And these horizontal planes exactly correspond to these horospheres. They exactly correspond to these shrinking tori as you go out. So the thing I talked about last time is an ideal simplex has a shape. Its shape is determined by a complex number that mustn't be 0, 1, or infinity. And the way you see that in this picture is when you go high up and you intersect the simplex with one of these horospheres, you actually see a Euclidean triangle. And, there's a metric. If you restrict the hyperbolic metric to this horosphere, you have a metric on this horosphere, and it's a Euclidean metric. But as you move upwards, this Euclidean metric shrinks. So this triangle's got a well-defined Euclidean structure, not quite, because it's only defined up to scale. So it's got a well-defined, well, it's not a Euclidean triangle, but it's well-defined up to Euclidean similarity. So the shapes of triangles up to Euclidean similarity are determined by a complex number. You can think of this as a triangle in the complex plane and normalize it so 2 of the vertices are at 0, 1, the last one's at z. So another way to think about what's going on here, if you take the group of hyperbolic isometries fixing the point at infinity, those correspond to the matrices in SL2C of this shape. And those correspond to Möbius transformations of the form Z maps to a scalar times Z plus a scalar. So if you think about this, this is a group of transformations of a complex plane. It's the affine group. It's a one-dimensional complex affine group. Z maps to multiple of Z plus A. The one-dimensional complex affine group is another way of saying the group of Euclidean similarities. So the deal is that if you glue these tetrahedra together, what you're going to end up with in general is a similarity structure on the torus rather than a Euclidean structure. And the completeness condition that you need for the cusps is that this similarity structure is actually a Euclidean structure. In other words, that's a condition that the linear part of the holonom is actually trivial, that all these factors here, the lambdas, are all 1.
No,
I'm not identifying the green torus and the blue torus. What I'm saying is that this picture is not well defined. The way it's not well defined is I don't know which torus to take. And that means that I don't get a well defined Euclidean triangle. It's only well defined up to scaling. And so it's a similarity class of Euclidean triangle. That's the only thing that's well defined. There's no kind of God-given torus here to work with. And the kind of a different way to think about it is that the group of hyperbolic isometries fixing a point at infinity can be identified with the group of Euclidean similarities on the plane. So I'm just going to indicate kind of how you can read off this completeness condition. So here's a very simple example where the imagine we've got a torus. In that previous picture, we had this manifold that was triangulated, had a triangulation by ideal three-dimensional simplices. And those simplices, I mean, they have spikes going out into the cusp. And maybe you have a situation where there are several cusps, and there's one cusp that only has two spikes of simplices going out into it. So you see a triangulation of that boundary torus by two triangles. These triangles are the cross-sections of two of the spikes of tetrahedra we had a moment ago. So what we have is a similarity structure. If the gluing equations are satisfied around every edge, then you have an incomplete hyperbolic structure, and that will give a similarity structure on this torus. And you can work out what the holonomy is for this similarity structure from these parameters. And the condition for a complete structure is that the Euclidean, the similarity that takes this edge to this edge, I mean, it should be a pure translation. The linear part of the holonom is trivial. Now, once you know the... So what we have is the shape parameters for these tetrahedra. And so that tells you the shapes of these Euclidean triangles. And so there's a Euclidean similarity that takes this edge to that edge, and because of my conventions, instead of multiplying by z, I'm going clockwise, so that's actually multiplying by the multiplicative inverse of z, 1 over z. And then again, to take this edge to this edge with the arrow shown, that's multiplying by the reciprocal of this parameter. And to take this edge to this edge, it's multiplying by the reciprocal of that. So you take the reciprocal of these three things, and that's taken the edge with the arrow going this way to the edge with the arrow going that way, but that's wrong. For the Euclidean structure, the arrow is supposed to go this way. So the condition is that actually the argument of the product of these numbers isn't trivial, which it would be for a translation. It's actually pi. In other words, if you were to do this twice, I mean, if you took the square of this element, this would actually give you the right thing. So anyway, the basic point here is that the completeness condition is an equation that can be is of the form of a certain product of these invariances minus 1. or actually the argument is pi. Well, let's talk about similarity structures, because there's something now that struck me as odd in the paper when I saw it, whenever it was last time, and the word projective structure leapt into my mind for some reason. So let's say I'm going to talk a bit more about similarity structures on a torus. So here are two examples of Euclidean structure, of a similarity structure on a torus. The first one's a Euclidean structure. So we've got the complex plane, we've got z goes to z plus a, z goes to z plus b. A and b are two complex numbers, not real multiples of each other. If we quotient out the complex plane by that group of translations, we get the torus. And that's a Euclidean structure on the torus. On the other hand, here's a pair of similarities applied. One is z goes to 2z, so pushing away from the origin. And the other one is z goes to, 3e to the I theta z. Now, the keen eye will notice that 2 and 3 don't really match with this picture. This should be something more like, 1.3z. But anyway, so the point is, this is multiplication by some other complex number. And these things commute as they have to for the torus. And so I've kind of sketched here some kind of fundamental domain. So this is a similarity structure on the torus. You kind of take this region, you glue these sides together using these two maps, and you get a similarity structure on the torus. It isn't a Euclidean structure. So if you have a triangulation of the torus with many triangles, you can think about writing down gluing equations for those triangles to give you a similarity structure. And what we're going to do is, actually, we're going to write down the kind of equations we've been writing down. So, of course, a Euclidean triangle is parameterized by complex number z, and then there are a pair of other numbers that were on the previous transparency, which here are called z prime and z double prime, that are functions of z. And in fact, I've written them out here. And so, of course, all these three numbers, these other two numbers, z prime and z double prime, can be derived from z, and they satisfy these two equations. And now, so the condition for a similarity structure then is that if you have a triangulation of the torus, you assign, if you like, three numbers to every triangle. You put in these equations, and then the condition that you have a similarity structure is that around every vertex, the product of the labels around that vertex is 1. And if you have a solution of those equations, that gives you a similarity structure. There's a little bit of fussing. This condition shouldn't really be the product complex numbers is 1. It should be the sum of the logarithms is 2 pi I. You want the angle around a vertex to be 2 pi, not 4 pi. Okay, so one can write down equations that give you whose solutions correspond to similarity structures on a torus. Now then, suppose you leave out some of these equations. So for some reason, the first set of equations, the product of the invariance is minus 1, is called phase space. And this other equation is called the Lagrangian. Anyway, if you just leave out this second set of equations, you've now got a process where you take a triangulation of the surface and you write down some equations. You write down the equations around a vertex and you write down these equations, but you don't write down those. So the solutions don't correspond to similarity structures. And the question is, do they correspond to anything at all that I can understand? Well, if you do a crude dimension count, then you discover that the number of dimensions in the solution space is 8 times the Euler characteristic of the surface you get by deleting the vertices. Now, 8, by coincidence, is the dimension of PGL3R. And so this leads us to projective structures. So the suspicion is that when you leave out these extra equations, and I haven't had time to check this, but when you leave out these other equations, the solutions to the equations that are left behind are actually a vector space. And there's a way of thinking of the space of projective structures on a surface that makes it into a vector space or something close to it. These are the so-called Fock-Goncharov coordinates. So I'm wondering if there's a relation. In any case, these are what I'm about to talk about. So let's think about a real projective structure on a surface. So what does that mean? Well, I'm going to look at a special kind of structure called a convex projective structure. So what this means is you have an open convex set in the real projective plane called omega. And you have the group of automorphisms of the projective plane, PGL3R. Maybe there's a subgroup gamma of PGL3R that preserves this domain omega. In which case you can form the quotient of the domain by this group and you get some orbifold, or if the group's torsion free, a surface F. And this is what a projective structure on a surface is, a convex projective structure. So the special case when omega is the round disk, this is exactly what a hyperbolic structure on a surface is. So you can think of this as a kind of generalization of a hyperbolic structure where you consider more general domains omega than a round disk. Now, it's a theorem due to various people that the space of projective structures on a given surface F is homeomorphic to Euclidean space whose dimension is 8 times the absolute value of the Euler characteristic of a surface. Well, the number 8, as I mentioned a moment ago, is the dimension of, the number 8 is the dimension of the Lie group in question here, the group of automorphisms of the projective plane. So the Titmuller space is parameterized by a point in this topological space. And
so that's just a homeomorphism.
And there are words you can say here, Higgs bundle and Hitching component and so on. Then Fock and Goncharov looked at this a different way. So Fock and Goncharov give coordinates. Well, they don't quite give coordinates. So the good news is that they give you a vector space. And the bad news is that points in that vector space aren't in 1-1 correspondence with projective structures. The correspondence is 2 to the power n to 1. Every projective structure on the surface corresponds to a certain number of points in parameter space. And the number of points in parameter space is 2 to the power the number of punctures. Their construction, I mean, the parameters are terribly nice and geometric, and so that's what I'm about to describe. So the way these parameters come about, you have a surface, and you have a surface with an ideal triangulation. So this surface actually is going to have punctures. It's got an ideal triangulation. And what they do is they assign one real number to every triangle, and they assign two real numbers to every edge. In fact, you can think of it as assigning one real number to each end of an edge. And they do it in a very geometric way. So the basic point is, if you have this triangulated surface, what you have is this domain is tiled by the ideal triangles that come from the surface. So here I've drawn one of these ideal triangles. So this ideal triangle's got 3 points on the boundary of this domain omega. And at those boundary points, there are 3 projective lines that are tangent to the domain. And so what you see is that this triangle has got 3 points on the boundary, but there are 3 preferred tangent lines there. So what you've actually got is a triangle with an inscribed triangle. And now that whole thing, you should only think about up to projective equivalence. So you should think, what are the possibilities for a triangle inscribed in another triangle up to projective equivalence? So the group of projective transformations preserving a triangle, well, if you think about the subgroup fixing each vertex, you can think of that as the diagonal group. It's an abelian group. It acts freely transitively on the interior of the triangle. And so if you just do a dimension count, I mean, we've got, there are 3 parameters, namely where these 3 red points sit on the edges of this triangle. But there's a 2-dimensional group, the subgroup, the diagonal group in SL2R acting on here. So 3 minus 2 is 1 parameters. And in fact, that parameter, if you write the points on the boundaries of these triangles in these projective coordinates, their product is invariant under the group. So this parameter T can be thought of as a point in the moduli space of a triangle inscribed in another triangle. So that's where these come from. And then the invariant at the end of an edge is basically a cross ratio. So when you have an edge in this triangulation, of course it's got a triangle on either side. So in the universal cover in the domain, what you see is 2 triangles, and their vertices are on the boundary of this domain. At the point in question P, there's a tangent line, a unique tangent line to the domain. So now if you think about it, we've got 4 lines going through this point. The tangent line, and then the 3 lines coming from the triangulation. And so these 4 lines going through this point are 4 points in a projective line, so they have a well-defined cross ratio. But in order to do that, you've actually got to orient this, you've got to pick an orientation. You either go clockwise or counterclockwise. So for each puncture, you have to artificially choose some orientation. And that's where this ambiguity comes in. So these are the Fock-Gonchiorov coordinates. So I'm kind of just beginning to wonder if these are connected to the equations you get when you drop the those extra equations.
These projective structures, I mean, how is it really different from, say, a manifold or a Euclidean structure? Is it just that the transition functions between your 2 charts are allowed to be projective maps and not just isometries?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a sense in which... So, the 3 constant curvature geometries, Euclidean geometry, spherical geometry, and hyperbolic geometry, are all subgeometries of projective geometry. So there's a sense in which it's more universal. And in particular, projective geometry, in general, is not a metric geometry. The Lie group's too big. I think I am done, unless anybody wants review from last week.
Would anybody like a review from last week? Where last week means last month.
Well, whenever it was, yeah. I've wrote all my old, I would say transparencies, but you know what I mean.
Opacities,
yeah. Pieces of paper.
Any questions?
So, to show my ignorance here, there's no easy connection between the cross ratio of ABCD versus DCBA?
Oh, there is. Yeah, no, there is.
The A might not be the A on the other side.
Well, no, it is. I mean, it's just a line. No, it is. I mean, I've got 4 lines going through a point. No, so there is some.
But, easy. Sorry, I thought maybe I understood Marty to be asking about the connection between E plus and E minus.
I wasn't thinking E plus.
Okay, sorry.
You said that you had to have 2 coordinates for each.
It's what comes out. I mean, to define the coordinate. Okay, so I should say a bit more. You could, I think, Yes, if you change orientation, you can compute how the coordinate changes. So I think you could form some quotient space. However, one of the remarkable things that Fock and Goncharov noticed is that all the parameters here are positive numbers. And in fact, you are in the realm of something called positive algebraic geometry. Everything is positive, and this seems to be a very important fact. And so if you do the kind of thing you're suggesting, you lose that. The fact that this isn't one-to-one, one shouldn't...
So in 2 weeks I will resume the talk about the paper and hopefully relate things to Fock and Goncharov coordinates if there is indeed a relation as we currently suspect.
Yeah, the paper is referenced. I mean, it's at the end of the paper, but it doesn't appear in the text.